As we did last week, this week we are also going to use our lesson this morning as an introduction to our study for tonight, because it's important, I think, for us to look at the entirety of the context, and we won't have time to do that tonight. And so we're going to take the time to do a little work on the context this morning. But it's going to be very important and beneficial for all of us. And if you'll take your Bibles and open with me to the book of Romans chapter 1, that's where we'll spend the majority of our time as we take a look at what is written in the book of Romans. I titled this first slide, An Amazing Book. And I'm not just talking about the book of Romans, although it would most definitely be included, but I'm talking about the entire Bible. Under any other circumstance, we would read the first chapter of the book of Romans with amazement. A letter that was written almost 2,000 years ago, and yet this letter will, in this first chapter, explain to us the why and the ways of avoiding and the way out of so many different problems that we face as human beings. But when we read this chapter, we have problems with it. We have difficulties with it. And that is the heart of the issue that we're going to be looking at this morning and again tonight. The first thing that we have to do, and the first thing that we have to recognize about ourselves and about others, is how are you reading this book? Not only how are you reading the Bible, but how are you reading this book of Romans, this chapter 1? And we're going to look at a quote tonight, and inside of the quotation, when you pay attention to all the things that are said in other places, and you kind of read between the lines and read under the surface, you begin to see the attitude that is taken with regard to this writing and to the words that we are about to read. So how do you take them, and how do you look at them? Do you look at them as words written by a man by the name of Paul who just happens to be sharing with us his thoughts and his ideas? Words that because they are from this man named Paul and because they are his ideas, words that can be easily dismissed by us and easily disagreed with by us. Because I'm going to tell you what we're about to look at and what we're about to read makes no sense in what we're most commonly told about ourselves and about how we are and why we are the way we are. And it goes completely against the things that especially we are told today in so many areas and in so many fields. And it's easy to dismiss. If I simply look at this as nothing more than the thoughts and the ideas of a man who happened to be named Paul. But it's completely different. If I understand that this man Paul is an apostle of Jesus Christ, which is the way he starts the letter. An apostle of Jesus Christ being guided by the Spirit of God. Being guided by the Spirit of God in such a way that what he writes is God himself talking to us. That God simply uses the Apostle Paul as his instrument to put the words on paper. But that the words are from God. And that the words reveal to us the mind of God and the will of God, which is exactly what the Apostle Paul will state in other places. He specifically writes to the church at Corinth, if there's anybody among you who thinks that he's spiritual, let him take note that the things that I write to you are the commandments of God, the commandments of Jesus Christ. So how do I view these words? How do I view this book? How do I view the Bible itself? a book to be dismissed, or God speaking to me. And God speaking to me means that what God says is right and true. And so many other things that I hear that differ from what God says cannot be true. So how do I read this book? So as we go through this book, we're going to start a little earlier than the reading. We're going to start in verse 13. And this morning we're going to look at two different things that become important in understanding this particular chapter. The first thing we're going to look at are the sections, the verses that have as the key word in them the word for or the word because. These are the passages that describe one right after the other the reason why the previous thing was said, the reason why the previous statement was given. And the Apostle Paul will use this word, or these two words, for and because. We're going to start the reading in verse 13. That's not exactly where he begins the usage of it, but we understand its first use of the word for if we understand a little bit about the background. And then we're going to go down through verse 22, and we're going to look at the word for and the word because, and these are key words. So read along with me. Romans chapter 1, starting with verse 13, and the Apostle Paul will write this. Sorry, private joke. I'll let you in on it. I have my notes up here, which are the same thing that are on the screen. And I had to make a copy this morning because I couldn't get my printer to print last night. So I came up and made copies this morning, and then I took one of my lessons and laid it on my desk for tonight and put the other one in my Bible for this morning. The one on my desk is this morning's lesson. And the one that's in my Bible is tonight's. So I'll be looking at what you're looking at. All right, let's go. Verse 13, and we start. I do not want you to be unaware, brethren, that often I've planned to come to you, and I have been prevented so far, so that I may obtain some fruit among you also, even as among the rest of the Gentiles. I've been planning to come to Rome for a long time, and I'm looking forward to it. I long to come to it. He just didn't anticipate it being in the way that he's going to get there. But he's heading to Rome eventually. I am under obligation both to Greeks and to barbarians, both to the wise and to the foolish. So for my part, I am eager to preach the gospel to you also who are in Rome. Why? For. So that. I'm eager to preach the gospel to you who are in Rome. For. I am not ashamed of the gospel. I am eager to preach to you the gospel. Because I am not ashamed of the gospel. Far from being ashamed of it. It's his life. It's what he's absolutely devoted to. And his love for all humanity drives this desire to share this message with all of humanity. And he's longing to come to Rome. And the reason is because he's not ashamed of the gospel of Christ. Well, Paul, why are you not ashamed of the gospel of Christ? For it is the power of God to salvation to everyone who believes, to the Jew first and also to the Greek. I am not ashamed of the gospel because it's the way God saves us. The gospel tells us about God's salvation. The gospel tells us about God's grace, God's mercy, what God has done for us. And because of what God has done for us, I want the whole world to know about this good news that is contained in the gospel. And that is why I'm not ashamed of it. And this gospel is so important for everyone, and it helps us to understand God's salvation. Because, in verse 17, for in it the righteousness of God is revealed from faith to faith. From beginning to end, it is by faith. As it is written, the righteous man shall live by faith. And Paul will go on to explain in the book of Romans that this gospel that I want to share with you makes known to us how God makes us righteous. And the way God makes us righteous is through the righteousness of Jesus Christ and our trust in Him. And so the question might be raised, if God makes us righteous in Jesus, then why is it so important that we have faith? Why is it so important that we trust Him and follow Him? Why do we have to trust Him and obey Him if we are saved by an act that Jesus Christ accomplished for us? It's the same question Paul's going to raise again that people are raising to him in Romans chapter 6. Since we are saved by God's grace, then why don't we just keep on sinning so that grace can abound? And Paul says, God forbid. Well, why is that something God would forbid? Why is that something that's wrong? Why is that thinking wrong? Verse 18. For the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who suppress the truth in unrighteousness. The wrath of God is revealed. How so? Through the times that He's already destroyed individuals? Through the reminder that He destroyed the entire world by the flood? Through the reminder of what He did to the nation of Israel and to the nation of Judah? Through the reminder of all the different cities that were destroyed because of their unrighteousness? How is God's wrath revealed? And how does it tie in with the gospel? It's Jesus on the cross. Because Jesus on the cross is not just giving us a demonstration of God's love. He's giving us a demonstration of God's wrath. The punishment of sin, which requires death. And a death of great suffering, but leading to His death. And in that death of Jesus on the cross, God demonstrates not only His love toward us, but also His wrath being poured out against the sins of all humanity and poured out in the person of Jesus Christ. God's wrath is revealed. That's why we must listen. That's why we must come to faith. That's why that faith must bring about a change in us, leading us to acknowledge our wrong and admit it, leading us to do everything we can by the power of Christ to turn away from the things that we do wrong and move toward Him. That's why it is absolutely essential that it be by faith, because of God's wrath, which is being poured out and revealed to us. Verse 19, because that which is known about God is evident within them, for God made it evident to them. These individuals who continue to live in ungodliness are suppressing the truth. These individuals who continue to live in ungodliness are either twisting the truth into something that it does not say, or they are absolutely ignoring it and paying no attention to it. And it is the case that they are suppressing the truth or hiding it or trying to put it away because that truth is known to every single one of them. Now, it's interesting here. Who's Paul talking to and talking about? We normally read Romans chapter 1, these first few verses, thinking that he's talking about the Gentiles, and he would be, individuals who did not have the law, but they had knowledge of God. And he's about to explain how they had knowledge of God. But the same thing that he says also applied to the Jews, who, while they were aware that God was on the mountain talking to Moses, they built that idol. And they built that idol and they rose up to play, to engage in whatever they wanted to engage in because the idol gave them permission. And they suppressed the truth of God on that mountain, giving his law and his instructions to Moses. And what is true of the Jews at Mount Sinai is true of all humanity. It's true of every single one of us. When we engage in unrighteousness, it's because we're suppressing truth. We're thinking we're an exception to the rule. We're thinking it doesn't count, it doesn't matter. We're thinking that it's unimportant, that it's insignificant. And that's what he's saying here. And now he says they're suppressing the truth, and that truth is something that they have all known, every single one of them. Every person in the world, he says so in verse 19, here's the reason why. Because that which is known about God, and he focuses on two things, that which is known about God is evident within them because God made it evident to them. What can be known about God is obvious to every person in the world because God made it obvious to every person in the world. How did he do that? How did he accomplish that? Next verse. For since the creation of the world, look at this. Look at this play on words, not really a play on words, but this, what do you call it, an oxymoron? For since the creation of the world, his invisible attributes, specifically two things, his eternal power and his divine nature, his eternal, everlasting, never coming to an end power, and his divine God nature. Not earthly, not temporary, not human. His divine nature. Have been clearly seen. Look at that. His invisible attributes are clearly seen. His invisible attributes, which you cannot see, are clearly seen and obvious. How's that? Being understood through what has been made, so they are without excuse. God is obvious. As a matter of fact, it's impossible to ignore him unless you deliberately choose to do so. Because his invisible attributes are there and they are clearly seen in everything that he's created and everything that he's made. Now, Paul is talking about creation in general, but as we go through this chapter and as we'll see tonight, he's going to come and pinpoint one specific thing that he has in mind. But that'll be for tonight. Don't you like this little segue into, I'm sorry, verse 21. Why are they without excuse? For even though they knew God, they didn't honor him as God or give thanks. But they became futile in their speculations, and their foolish heart was darkened. Professing to be wise, they became fools. Didn't you read those verses and just look at the world we're in today and say, wow, that's describing us. And that's describing what's going on around us. They knew God, but they didn't honor him as God. And because they didn't honor him as God and they did not give thanks to him, they became foolish and futile in their thinking. And they created some problems for themselves. Starting in verse 23, there's a change. And we'll move away for the most part from the for and the because passages, and we'll move into the exchange passages. There are three different things. Actually, you could go and say there's five different things. And there's going to be a pattern in these verses. And in these verses, the pattern is going to be that we changed or exchanged one thing for another. By our choice, we moved away from one thing and we moved to something else. We moved away from God and we moved toward ourselves. It's what he's going to make clear. But when we do that, then God lets us go. And the idea behind God lets us go, what does that mean? A couple of guys and things that I was reading had a little small disagreement with each other as to what it meant. One of them illustrated it this way. That when the Bible refers to God letting them go or letting us go, he pictures it as a boat in a rapids where God has hold of the boat and is maintaining it and keeping it safe from the harm that it could be caused in the rapids. But when the individual exchanges God for himself, then God lets go of the boat. So that the boat is adrift to the destruction that is inevitable. The other one said, I think it's a little more than just letting go. It's almost like God lets go and gives a little push. There is no doubt that the Bible will tell us all through its pages, and it's emphasized here again, that when we refuse to have God in our knowledge, he will let us go into our wickedness just about as far as we want to go, to the point we will destroy ourselves. So let's look at what he says starting in verse 23. The first exchange. Exchange. You had something. Well, I don't like that. So I want to exchange it for something else. They exchanged the glory of the incorruptible God for an image in the form of corruptible man and of birds and of four-footed animals and crawling creatures. Idolatry. Where we change the glory of God for a statue that you carve out of a piece of wood. Or a statue that you carve out of a piece of rock. Or for something that I want to delight in. Because it's really me talking through it. Because the statue can't talk. And the only thing that can give it words is me. So they exchanged the glory of the true, living, talking God for a rock or for a piece of wood. Therefore, because they did that, because they made that choice, because they chose to exchange God for that piece of wood, God gave them over. He let go of the boat. God gave them over in the lust or the desires of their hearts to impurity, so that their bodies would be dishonored among them. He let them go the way they wanted to go. And they gave themselves to their physical desires. 25. For they exchanged the truth of God for a lie and worshiped and served the creature rather than the Creator, who is blessed forever. Amen. I'm going to put the verses up that we're going to go and look at. But I want to bring your attention back to verse 25, and I want you to look at the difference. Because while verse 23 talks about idolatry and verse 25 is still talking about idolatry, there's a change in the wording. And I think the change in the wording is showing us something that is important and significant. Here's what they exchanged. They exchanged the truth of God, the truth of His reality, the truth of His word, the truth of His spoken word, what He's revealed to us. They exchanged the truth of God for a lie, something that is not true. And they worshiped and they served the creature rather than the Creator. What have they done? They have taken God off the throne and replaced Him with themselves. They no longer listen to what God says. They now do what they want to do. That's what they've done. That's the exchange that they've made. They've exchanged the truth of God for a lie, and they worship the creature themselves rather than the Creator who's blessed forever. For this reason, because of that, you understand why that Christianity is so hated in the world in which we live today? Because we hold up the truth of God to a world that says it's a lie. And they know it's true. And they want to shut us up. Can't prove us wrong. They want to shut us up. And it's always been that way. So here's what happens. Because they exchange God's truth for a lie that I can do what I want to do. For this reason, God let go of the boat. God gave them over to degrading passions. For their women exchanged the natural function for that which is unnatural. We'll talk more about natural and unnatural tonight. These two verses, verse 26 and verse 27, are deemed on both sides of the discussion to be the two most important passages in all of the Bible. Number one, because they're in the New Testament. But what's written here in the New Testament has as its background the books of Genesis and the book of Leviticus. The book of Genesis and the book of Leviticus. Passages we've already looked at. Because there's so much similarity, even in word usage, in what Paul writes here and what was written in Leviticus and what was written in Genesis. And in the same way, also, the men abandoned the natural function of the woman and burned in their desire toward one another. Men with men committing indecent acts and receiving in their own persons the due penalty of their error. Because they exchanged God's truth for a lie, God let them go. And here's where they went. And just as they did not see fit to acknowledge God any longer, here's our world in response to us. They no longer see fit to acknowledge God any longer. No longer do they see fit to tolerate anyone who does acknowledge God. God gave them over to a depraved mind to do those things which are not proper, being filled with all unrighteousness, wickedness, greed, evil, full of envy, murder, strife, deceit, malice. They are gossips, slanderers, haters of God, insolent, arrogant, boastful, inventors of evil, disobedient to parents, without understanding, untrustworthy, unloving, unmerciful. And although they know the ordinance of God that those who practice such things are worthy of death, they not only do the same, but they also give hearty approval to those who practice them. If you read the next verse, chapter 2, in verse 1, it says this. Therefore, you have no excuse. Every one of you who passes judgment, For in that which you judge another, you condemn yourself, for you who judge practice the same things. And the condemnation is hypocritical judgment, where I'm condemning someone else when I'm doing the same thing myself. And that hypocritical judgment. But there's a phrase that is used here. It's already been used in chapter 1. It's without excuse. Here, the Apostle Paul will write by God's demand or command, chapter 2 and verse 1, you have no excuse. The first place that he wrote that is back up in verse 20. In verse 20, he says, for since the creation of the world, his invisible attributes, his eternal power and divine nature have been clearly seen, being understood through what has been made, so that they are without excuse. And this is all coming out of the discussion on the wrath of God. One of the things that we must recognize and understand and emphasize in connection with the wrath of God is that we are without excuse with regard to God's wrath being leveled against us. All humanity is without excuse. Which means what? Which means all humanity is accountable. All humanity is accountable for knowing the Creator, because God made it obvious. All humanity is accountable for knowing about God. Because God, even before the Bible, made it obvious. And now, after the death of Jesus Christ, it is even more and more obvious. So every single one of us are without excuse, which means every single one of us are accountable. That also means every single one of us are responsible. We are responsible for what we do. We will be held accountable for what we do. Because in the mind of God and in the eyes of God, because of what He has done, every single one of us are absolutely without excuse. You know what that means in connection with the wrath of God? Every single thing we do, we can choose to do differently. Even in regard to following God, we can choose to ignore God. We can choose to exchange the truth about Him for a lie. Well, if we can choose to exchange the truth about Him for a lie, we can choose to stop believing the lie and hold to the truth about God. We have choice. That's why we are without excuse. We have choice, and we can choose to do differently. In other words, we can help it. And how many times do we say, I just can't help it? And Romans chapter 1 says, that's not right. That's exchanging the truth about God for a lie. We can help it. Go back to the Genesis chapter 4, 6 and 7. We'll close with these two verses. One of my favorite teachers growing up was Franklin Camp. Many of you may know Franklin Camp. Well, I love listening to him. Brother Cecil May is very much like Franklin Camp to me. But I love Franklin Camp. And Brother Camp used to always say, there is not a subject in the Bible that is not started in Genesis. And in order to prove that, all you had to do was sit in one of his classes. I think I've mentioned before, Adamsville told him, we want you to teach the book of Romans, and there will be no time limit. You will not be limited to a quarter. You will not be limited to a time. And we want you to teach the book of Romans. An individual went to the first class and heard it. And I think it was 2 or 3 years later, I'm not sure what the time frame was, it may have been 2 or 3 years later that he had opportunity to go back. And when he went back, Brother Camp said, okay, we're ready to continue with our study in Romans, so open your books to Romans chapter 1, verse 4. because everything went back to Genesis. And to get an understanding of Romans, they went back to Genesis. Genesis chapter 4, 6 and 7, what God says, and what God says to Cain, "Why are you angry?" What do you think he would have said if he said, "I can't help it"? Oh, really? The very question says you can help it. The very question says you have choice. Why are you angry? And why has your countenance fallen? Why are you allowing the emotions inside of you to exist? If you do well, if you make the right choice, if you choose to do the right thing, will not your countenance be lifted up? Your emotions and your feelings are controlled by your choice of action. Your choice of action. And if you do not do well, if you choose not to do what you ought to do, sin is crouching at the door, and its desire is for you. But you must master it. No excuse. We have choice. And even when we've made wrong choice, we still have choice to come back and do the right thing or to continue to believe the lie. We have choice. So is a man writing this in Romans, or is God? Is God telling me about myself? Is God telling me about all humanity? Or is this just the ideas of a man? Do I hold to the truth of God, or do I exchange it for a lie? No excuse is what God tells us. This morning, we need to all ask ourselves, am I trusting God and am I submitting to Him? Am I living as God would have me to live? Am I making the choice to believe that He's right, to believe that He is, and to believe that in Him, I can do all things because of the strength that He gives me in Christ Jesus? Do you need to come home to God? Do you need to be immersed into Christ? If you need to respond to His invitation, we offer that invitation to you as together we stand and as we sing.
There's a fountain of praises for you and me. Let us hear.